Midstream.
Have passed since the launch of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah, a memory dear to the heart of every believer in the inevitability of divine victory, and for every believer who dreams of a day free from injustice and oppression in a nation that has nursed injustice and oppression since its early beginnings. With their tender flesh, they resisted, struggled, and persevered. They all came out of small houses from besieged neighborhoods. They saw their families being humiliated at checkpoints, their mothers killed, their fathers' bodies dismembered, their livelihoods stolen at the hands of an enemy wreaking havoc and terror in their country. It was then when the dawn of the resistance broke out in Beirut and South Lebanon. Those few defeated the mightiest of armies, obliging them to retreat towards the so-called occupied strip. Throughout 40 years, their brown hands wove the scarf of freedom to be completed in the year 2000. Victories rolled in until a 2006 victory that shook all corners of the earth. Who are they, those few Arab men who made miracles and defeated the army that was once called the undefeatable army? 40 years of effort, resistance, glory, liberation, dignity, and martyrdom. 40 years of generosity to the homeland and to the ultimate freedom of all the oppressed in the world. Hezbollah, which offered redemption to the Arabs, presented above all the eloquent lesson of victory, how the martyr with pure blood turned everything around him into a force capable of steadfastness and victory. Hezbollah transformed the dirt of betrayal, disappointment, and continuous Arab failure into steadfastness, hope, and victory. 40 years later, Hezbollah became a party that the enemy fears and respects at the same time. A resistance that is keen to reveal, but its silence is a message in itself, which many seek to decipher. 40 years and Hezbollah is rooted in Lebanon, fixed in this country as firmly as its mountains. Its upbringing was not fleeting or devoid of Lebanese history and geographical extension around which a large group of Lebanese gathered, because Hezbollah represented the legitimacy of the resistance to liberate Lebanon, protect it, and contribute to building its state. It is the 40 springs, 40 wisdom, knowledge, patience, morals, and humility. It is 40 strength, power, honor, dignity, and victory. 40 years in which there is no aging, because this party has different, multiplied, interconnected generations always ready to serve the honorable march of Hezbollah. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Years have passed since the launch of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah, a memory dear to the heart of believers in the inevitability of divine victory. It might not be an exaggeration to say that in the past century, it has been very rare to find an organization in this region that had such presence, resonance, and influence as much as Hezbollah. It is true that there are entities that passed through this region and had a presence and a transnational influence, but they did not live long in this role due to their lack of ability to reconcile principle and flexibility and their lack of understanding of reality. Hezbollah was able to develop a special model based on its ideological structure, its rich jihadi experience, and the peculiarity of the Lebanese reality. It combined its first identity as a resistance against the Zionist occupation, the American hegemony, and the imperatives of engaging in this Lebanese political spectrum. To discuss this issue, with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament for the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah. It's a pleasure always having you with us, Sayyid Moussaoui. Now, beginning with the 40 years, the 40 springs of Hezbollah, Hezbollah has been rooted in Lebanon representing the legitimacy of the resistance that has liberated Lebanon, further wants to protect it, and also wants to contribute to building the state. Throughout these 40 years, what was the most challenging role of all these three representations?
Thank you for the introduction. This is a very fascinating and very well done presentation about the organization, about the party, about the resistance, about the very sophisticated role in Lebanon. We know very well that Hezbollah has been engaged as a political party and as a resistance movement in so many different activities. It's not only limited to the military part. Part of it, when you talk about war, you talk about disasters of war. When we found ourselves under the occupation by the Israeli occupation that is being backed by the Americans and the Western governments and many of the retrogressive Arab systems as well, we had to deal with the calamities of the occupation. When you talk about occupation, you talk about aggressions, invasions, killings, destruction, and you have to remedy all. You have to take care of the orphans that come after their fathers are dead. You have to deal with those whose houses are being destroyed. You have to deal with other social and livelihood issues. So it's a very sophisticated, very combined, very complicated task that Hezbollah has, if you want, shouldered in the country. Mm-hmm. When, if you ask me about the most difficult issue, this has been said by the Secretary General, the leader of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. When you talk about building the government, when you talk about building the political system, when you talk about building the state entities, here is the problem, because we have faced corruption. Sayyid Nasrallah said it once that fighting Israel is maybe 2,000 times easier than fighting the corruption within the system in
Professor,
Lebanon.
40 years now, during which Hezbollah did not work as a resistance to the occupation only, but although it precedes all its actions from the necessity of this resistance, we have also the cultural, the economic, and the political levels that Hezbollah has been engaged in. Now, Hezbollah also cares about the fate and the future of Lebanon and contributes to the establishment of a more just society, a society that the Lebanese maybe aspire to have someday all across the Lebanese spectrum. Some would say that Hezbollah has failed politically. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, it's very simple to say Hezbollah has failed or Hezbollah has won. If we want to give a very meticulous, a very accurate, a very precise answer to this question, you have to dig deep down into the ailments of the system of Lebanon. This political system has many ailments and has many problems. I did say something about the confessionalism, about the sectarianism, about this, if you want, kind of dictation by the outside. Lebanon has never been at any time a very free country. Why are we suffering from what we are suffering? If we talk about electricity that has, if you want, consumed one-third of the debts of Lebanon, $40 billion have been put into electricity, and we don't have electricity till now. No infrastructures, no whatever. They are still talking about building plants in order to produce electricity. Why is that? It's because of corruption. Mm-hmm. Why corruption? It's because of confessionalism, sectarianism. The ailments of the system dates long time before the advance of Hezbollah. Hezbollah has not been there when all of this, if you want, sectarian system has been built by the outside forces. And again, if you ask me what's the problem now, I tell you it's the American dictations, it's the American intervention, the American interference. The American ambassador, and all Lebanese know that as a fact, the American ambassador promised that we will have electricity in 1 month a year ago, and we don't have it up till now. Why is that? It is because that they are dictating upon the Lebanese not to take any help from Iran, from Russia, from China, from anywhere.
Well, Professor, Hezbollah is indebted to its Lebanese people for their honorable sacrifices. No one can deny that, nor do they have the right to. It is indebted to the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Everyone also knows that. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Al-Quds Force, we also know that. And to the leadership of the leader of the revolution, Sayyid Imam Ali Khamenei. who is on the path of late Imam Ruhullah Khomeini. But does this all make Hezbollah in particular an extension of Iranian influence in West Asia, as the foes of Hezbollah always put it in Lebanon?
Well, the foes of Hezbollah, those who wants to really know the reality of Hezbollah, they know very well that thanks to the Iranian Islamic Republic, thanks to Imam Khamenei, thanks to Imam Khomeini, we are proud to have this relation. It's an honorable thing to have a relation with such a great civilization, with such a great republic, with such a great state. Everybody knows that the Iranians are challenging, and Sayyid Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, and we challenge them to provide one evidence, one shred of evidence that we have put anything other than our national interest, our national priority, our Lebanese priority. Yes, our relation with Iran is very public, is very open. It's not a secret, but I can tell you very well that Hezbollah is in a position to make influences on the approaches of Iran towards not only Lebanon, towards the Arab region as well, more than Iran has influence on Hezbollah. Why? Because there is this such great respect and the trust to Hezbollah capabilities, not only on the military level, but also on the political level, on this maturity of decision, on this wisdom of the leadership of Hezbollah in order to make the good things to Lebanon and to the region. That's why all of these things that they talk about, and here I go back to your previous question about whether Hezbollah failed or succeed or didn't succeed or it was a problem. No, it cannot be weighed this matter, actually. You have to see what kind of conspiracies have been planned and plotted against Hezbollah, against Lebanon. And you see that all through the conspiracies, all through the battles, all through the wars, we have succeeded in them all, didn't we? Mm-hmm. We remember the assassination of Hariri, and they wanted to make this fitna between Sunnites and Shias. And Sayyid Nasrallah took the initiative and he started to move all over, risking his life just to sabotage these efforts of fitna. Take the 2006 war, what they did. Take the Syrian war, when Hezbollah took the decision early enough because of his wisdom, leadership, in order to go and fight there. It's always the case now. After the 40 years, now the 40 years of Hezbollah, Hezbollah is proving to be not only a safety valve for Lebanon, but only for the region, and not only for Lebanon on protecting and liberating the territories, now in protecting the fortunes. Now America and the West, they have only paid attention to Lebanon when Sayyid Nasrallah came 2 weeks ago, and they said, if we are going to be denied our right in our gas and in our oil, in the sea, no one is going to extract a drop of oil.
And
that's why
this put everyone on their toes there.
Absolutely.
And put especially the Americans
true.
In Lebanon.
Very true. And now we have been able to listen to the positive mm-hmm. reaction from the Americans. Now they are ready to discuss with Lebanon because, you know, again, I go to the wisdom of the leadership. About the assessment, the meticulous, precise assessment, we are in a very rare moment of strategic opposition to the Israeli-American imperialist project in the region and in the world. Because of this Ukrainian-Russian war, they want to spare and they want to make sure that they can take every drop and every shred of gas from the region and from all over the world. That's why it's our term to dictate our conditions.
And as
in
clear
order,
as I see you, Professor Moussaoui, all the Lebanese people, just like I am, even if I'm going to sound biased here, but I'm Lebanese first and foremost.
Absolutely.
I know that our wealth is in good hands since it is in the hands
absolutely.
Of the resistance. I want to thank you very much, Professor Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament, for the loyalty to the resistance bloc Hezbollah, for joining us on the 40th spring of Hezbollah. Thank you for your time. And please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the faith of the Mujahideen of Hezbollah.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
40 years of jihad, during which the resistance Hezbollah changed the balance of power after it was a group of oppressed, believing mujahideen. They worked towards Allah, so the Almighty helped them and made their stance firm. 40 years during which the youth of Hezbollah were raised on good intentions, faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and good morals. The people loved them. They loved their people back. And they were worthy of giving, of sacrifice, of steadfastness, and trust. This made their opponents, their enemies, and their friends as well believe in their capabilities and in their will and their strength and the determination to become victorious. And here they are. After they achieved the dream of liberation in 2000 and victory in July 2006 and liberation from Takfiri terrorism, they made people believe that with the presence of this resistance, a liberated Al-Quds has become closer. Hezbollah, 40 years young, in this following report.
For 40 years, Hezbollah did not leave Lebanon vulnerable to the projects of partition, normalization, and bargaining, and did not abandon its responsibilities towards the Lebanese. This is what made the U.S. and their allies try to distort its image and hold it responsible for the crises hitting Lebanon, in order to exonerate the allies of America who stole Lebanon and plundered it with their policies and behaviors from the 90s until today. For 40 years, the experience of Hezbollah has been pure white at all levels and according to its capabilities, at the top of which is resistance. Then comes politics, development, helping the poor and the vulnerable to overcome crises, breaking the siege in oil derivatives, and helping out in the file of medicine and foodstuffs and other files such as electricity, water, and the development of towns, roads, and infrastructure. For 40 years, Hezbollah did not abandon its Lebanese role and did not depart from Lebanese concerns, except when it works in regional files. It works out of the necessity of making use of its power to liberate Lebanon from American hegemony and to make Lebanon a country with institutions and a free decision. A state whose political and economic system is built according to the visions and aspirations of its people, not through the visions and aspirations of the Americans, the Zionists, the regional countries of normalization, and some of their tools that seek to achieve their goals in Lebanon, to make it a riot for those tools in order to achieve American and Zionist projects. This is how Hezbollah is working on all files at home and abroad, based on the Lebanese interest first and foremost. For Hezbollah, Palestine is the axis and the central issue. Hezbollah has always been supportive of the Palestinian people and their resistance to liberate their land, believing that there is no solution, neither through settlement, nor with American sponsorship, nor by relying on the Security Council, which is manipulated by the United States and Israel. Hezbollah's resistance has become the flame of the tripartite of light, liberation, independence, and protection. And it is the pillar of strong Lebanon in its tripartite, as it is the supporter of the peoples of the region and the axis of resistance. 40 years during which the youth of Hezbollah were raised on good intentions, faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and good morals. So Allah loved them, and they loved him back. And people loved them, and they loved their people. And they were worthy of giving, sacrifice, steadfastness, and trust, which made their opponent, their enemy, and their friend believe in their abilities, their will, their strength, and their determination to victory.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Sheikh Khudr Nuruddin, member of the Hezbollah Political Council. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Samaht Sheikh Khudr Nuruddin. Thanks a million for your time. Now, there are certain basic and decisive elements that made Hezbollah such a strong presence, among them the dimension of faith, which urges its members to endure and to sacrifice, represented in the trilogy of faith, jihad, and martyrdom. However, this dimension has been heavily criticized, especially lately, when it comes to a systematic campaign to demonize Hezbollah inside Lebanon and the region because of its faith and the ideology, separating it from what they so call it, the Lebanese culture. How effective do you think such campaigns are, and what is the importance of faith element in the presence of Hezbollah?
In the name of Allah, the most gracious and the most merciful, Salam be upon he who have revived the Islam of Muhammad, peace be upon him, and brought us back to the fields of confrontation against falsehood. For your question, considering Hezbollah to be on the side of righteousness, was first involved in liberating the land and the detainees. Our ground rule in dealing with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the Quranic verse, and if you help Allah, Allah will help you and make your feet firm. Added to that, the passion towards Allah that Imam Khomeini revived in our mind and soul, seeking divine satisfaction was the goal, and from there, the fear of death was gone. When a human fears death, he falls. Usually enemies and tyrants raise fear in the hearts of people through death. So when humans challenge death and consider it to be a chance to meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala after fulfilling their role, just like what Imam Ali and Imam Hussein did, then this weapon of fear falls. When this weapon fell, the enemy, Israel in specific, became exposed. The enemy's truth was revealed. Israel is weaker than a spider's web. Israel is built on mere media propaganda. This is why in 2006 we saw this horrifying fall of the Zionist entity. The prestige that Israel used to jump from one victory to the other against Arab countries was broken in Hezbollah's 2000 victory. This victory was attained through the belief of the resistance in its legitimacy and its rights and its perseverance to attain these rights. This victory not only broke Israel, but also remotivated the Palestinians and revived the Arab hope. After the Arab regimes had killed that hope so as to push the public to surrender under the slogan that the Zionist army is undefeatable. However, this slogan was broken in the battlefield.
Well, aside from that, we also see that in the stage of getting involved in Lebanese politics and the internal hardships of the Lebanese politics, it was accompanied by the development of Hezbollah's institutions and organizations, like, for example, media organizations, educational ones, cultural ones, social, agricultural, urban, medical, financial, and even sports and scouts. Given the financial crisis that has hit Lebanon since 2019, how has these institutions been handy without becoming a state within a state?
In general, yes, Hezbollah institutions, which you mentioned, were filling in the place of absent government institutions. Hence, what was intended for a clash between us and the government under the title Hezbollah is a state within the state was dropped, simply because we never took the place of the government and refused to do so despite many events that made way for us to do so. For example, in the 2000 liberation, we were fully capable of taking revenge from the Lebanese Zionists agents who killed our people and our fighters. However, we completely left this matter to the hands of the government and its justice system, regardless of the results of the judiciary, because we never intended to take the role of governance or to eliminate its role to begin with. Also, another example is the so-called 2019 October Revolution, which took place in Beirut, planned and led by what I call the American ogre, the American devil, which aimed to push the Lebanese public to clash with Hezbollah and hold him responsible for bringing down the country. However, good leadership and wisdom in dealing with this event led to the failure of the American project completely. Finally, they failed and we in Hezbollah remained under the umbrella of the government, always reassuring the public that we abide by our golden tripartite: the army, the people, and the resistance. Therefore, we never were taking the role of the government, and we never will be doing so in the future. On the contrary, we shall be at the service of our government and our army.
Well, between the year 1982, the date of inception, the date of birth, and today in 2022, reaching for the 40th of maturity, a timeline filled with the colors of challenges and of storms in which things were very hard for Hezbollah, yet in several stations, God secured a way out for the Mujahideen of Hezbollah. In some of them, the hearts of the lovers trembled, and the haters claimed that the party had fallen and was about to meet its end fate. Clear propaganda, obviously, yet how would you suggest the toughest challenge has been so far for Hezbollah as a whole?
In my personal opinion, I believe that the biggest challenge that Hezbollah ever faced was trying to get Hezbollah involved in internal turmoil, shifting the resistance weapons compass instead of being directed toward the temporary Zionist enemy. It was intended to make these weapons face the interior Lebanese society. The wisdom of our leadership and the political awareness built inside the society of resistance, supporters and fighters, which Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah reflected upon as being sharp insight. This led to the failure of the enemy plans and resulted in our benefit rather than theirs. Here I mentioned the patience that we in Hezbollah endured and our people endured. Our affirmation and concern for stability and internal civil peace brought down the U.S. plans of chaos in Lebanon and brought the resistance closer to its own people internally, where we now have strong allies in the Christian sect, which were once misled by false propaganda and lies.
Well, I want to thank you very much from Beirut, Sheikh Khudr Nuruddin, member of the Hezbollah Political Council, for your time and contribution as we celebrate really 40 years of resistance in Lebanon, resistance of Hezbollah. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more hot topics from the Mideast Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Greenpeace filed lawsuit against the UK government recently, contending that the recent approval of a new North Sea gas field was unlawful because officials refused to evaluate how greenhouse gas pollution from Shell's so-called Jackdaw project will exacerbate the climate emergency. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stencil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Greenpeace sues UK government to stop massive offshore drilling project. Here's more. Greenpeace filed suit against the UK government recently, contending that the recent approval of the new North Sea gas field was unlawful because officials refused to evaluate how greenhouse gas pollution from Shell's so-called Jackdaw project will exacerbate the climate emergency. When the UK government greenlit more drilling off the coast of Aberdeen on June 2nd without an adequate assessment of the overall emissions impact, it failed to uphold its legal obligation to account for the climate damages caused by the increased extraction and burning of fossil fuels, Greenpeace argues. Greenpeace estimates that if burnt, gas extracted from Shell's Jackdaw development will generate more carbon dioxide than the annual emissions of Ghana. Last year, the International Energy Agency made clear that new fossil fuel projects are incompatible with the Paris Agreement's goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The legal challenge comes as UK residents are enduring deadly extreme heat and skyrocketing energy bills. Reliance on fossil fuels lies at the heart of both problems, Greenpeace says, and Jackdaw will only make things worse. Even UK officials have admitted that the project is unlikely to reduce household energy costs because Shell will sell the gas to whichever country is willing to pay the most for it. This Jackdaw approval is a scandal, Philip Evans, an oil and gas transition campaigner for Greenpeace UK, said in a statement, adding, "The government knows that burning fossil fuels drives the climate crisis, yet they are approving a new gas field in June without proper climate checks and declaring a national emergency over heat waves in July. Meanwhile, household bills are soaring and the government is ignoring common sense solutions like home insulation, heat pumps, and cheap renewable power," said Evans, adding, "We believe this is an astonishing dereliction of the government's legal duty and we won't let it stand. So we are taking legal action to stop Jackdaw, and whenever we see the government acting unlawfully to green light new fossil fuels, we stand ready to fight in the courts." UK policymakers said last March that they would soon use a climate compatibility checkpoint when making decisions about new fossil fuel licenses so that future offshore oil and gas exploration could only proceed if found to align with the UK government's net zero strategy. Environmental groups were furious to learn a few months later, however, that previously licensed developments are exempt from more rigorous tests. Jackdaw is one of the 46 projects with the capacity to produce up to 2.1 billion barrels of oil equivalent over their combined lifetimes, enough to generate more than twice as much carbon dioxide pollution as the UK economy spews into the atmosphere each year. That could be approved between 2022 and 2025 as a result of this loophole. It is completely irrational for the UK government to approve and heavily subsidise a project like Jackdaw that does nothing to address the energy price crisis while contributing to climate change, activist Lauren MacDonald said recently, adding, "Our dependence on fossil fuels is at the root of both crises, yet the government continues to try and plough ahead with new oil and gas projects. This is why we need legal action. As long as the government carries on down this path, ignoring the pressing need to insulate homes and roll out cheaper renewables, they will face backlash and legal challenges. Scottish courts will now decide whether to grant Greenpeace permission to move ahead with its new lawsuit against the government. That may not happen until after the Supreme Court decides whether to grant Greenpeace permission to challenge BP's permit to extract oil from the Worleash field," The group appealed to the Supreme Court after losing its initial case against the Woolrich project last year, when Scottish courts sided with the government's argument that climate impacts are not relevant to fossil fuel permit decisions. Freya Hutchinson, an oil and gas campaigner at Friends of the Earth Scotland, welcomed Greenpeace's legal challenge to the government's approval of Shell's Jackdaw gas field. He said the UK government must stop issuing any new fossil fuel licenses and instead start planning for a managed phase-out of production with a just transition for workers and communities. A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
A summit of sorts, or opposing sides, Iran held its seventh summit under the Astana process. That's Syrian peace talks it co-sponsors with Russia and Turkey. It was on Tuesday, July the 19th, 2022, when Iranian, Russian and Turkish heads of states came together in the Iranian capital Saadabad Palace to discuss security in Syria as a prerequisite for lasting security in the region, among other matters. The summit was aimed at ending the Turkish offensive in northern Syria. But in every tripartite effort, it takes three to aim straight. The dynamics of how allies and alliances pursue even the same goal is a 500-piece puzzle. Let's start putting the pieces together for a general idea. Here with me, Leila Faramarzi on Iran Today. Turkish President Erdogan said that his country's problem with Syria is due to the terrorist groups operating there and threatening the territorial integrity of Turkey. On his method of combating the threat, though, he hasn't managed to convince his two counterparts. Iran maintains securing Turkish territory shouldn't compromise Syria's territorial integrity. Russia agrees with Iran in a manner uncharacteristic of its later Tsarist era, Soviet era, and Afghan incursion decades. Mr. Modabbir joined us on Skype as we had to hear his take on the summit.
We have defined that there is no differentiation between terrorists in Syria. A terrorist is a terrorist. All terrorist movements in Syria must be restrained, and countries must use the tools that were mentioned, such as prohibiting the delivery of foodstuff. Water, especially water. As you know, unfortunately, Turkey has cut off Syria's access to drinking water in some areas and has created obstacles. Well, these actions are not compatible with the process of negotiations. Therefore, Turkey must honor the agreements that were made and take the path in which the Assad government takes center stage at the legitimate government and remove the terrorist movement itself. This is how we can achieve a substantial mutual understanding in Syria.
President Raisi, at the summit opening, said Iran's position vis-à-vis the conflict in Syria is to maintain the territorial integrity of Syria and reach a political solution without foreign interference. In line with that, Putin, president of Russia, stressed Iran, Russia and Turkey must make a joint effort to help the Syrian people rebuild their country, saying that this means reactivating the economy of the country and also re-establishing the social sector, returning the immigrants, refugees and displaced persons to their homes. Turkey's Erdogan, though, has been trying to convince his two counterparts of the necessity of his military methods in north and northeast Syria. Still, all three countries, as guarantors of peace in Syria, did agree to continue using the Astana mechanism, or Astana peace process, which was adopted in 2017 in Kazakhstan in order to work towards a Syrian peace process. Mr. Qaim Maghami is an expert on Turkey who received us in his home.
In addition to the Astana, there is the Sochi process, which was signed and implemented by Russia and Turkey. Because there had been conflicts in Idlib and northern Syria, and Russia and Turkey tried to implement it, which is somewhat complementary to the Astana agreement. And they were successful to some extent. But Iran did not participate in the Sochi meeting and was mostly an observer.
Talks at the summit circled around much more than one talking point. Following them, Iran's foreign ministry published a 16-point joint statement. In it, attention is also paid to the global food and energy crises generated by the Ukraine war. Talks also tended to completing the Rasht-Astara railway line and completing the north-south transit corridor. This is of joint interest to Iran and Russia, both of whose presidents commended their leap in bilateral ties, especially in economy, security, infrastructure, energy, trade and industry. They also gave themselves a pat on the back for countering terrorism in Syria and so promoting security and stability in the region, when others in West Asia only spoke of doing so. Let's not forget, hours before Putin landed in Tehran, Iran's NOC, National Oil Company, and Russia's gas giant Gazprom signed a memorandum of understanding worth some $40 billion. Under this deal or understanding, Russia will help develop the Kish and North Pars gas fields, as well as six oil fields in Iran. Turkey's achievement in its Iran ties is less certain. But to look at Iran-Turkey ties before tension, the trade level between the two countries can reach $30 billion. That's more than three times its current level. And Iran and Turkey have signed eight memoranda of cooperation in different fields, namely radio and television. A key topic on the agenda was the renewal of Turkey's gas purchase contract with Iran. The contract expires in 2025, left as it is. Erdogan, for his part, also said a few words on terrorism. We should confront terrorist organizations with all-out solidarity. The words are the same, but like I said, the method is different, as is the side Turkey has picked thus far. Mr. Horsand came to the studio to share his views on the Russian aspect of the summit.
Turkey is experiencing confusion and perplexity in its foreign policy. Turkey was not even accepted by the West, and Turkey's case to join the European Union has become a trifling matter for the EU, and on the other hand, the Turkey that tried so hard to convince Saudi Arabia to join the Abraham Peace Accords tried so hard to fill the gap of the US in Afghanistan and provide services there as the US used to do. It tried so hard to help Ukraine in the Ukrainian war, but we saw that in the conflict between Turkey and Greece, the Americans didn't even remain neutral. All of this have created a situation where Turkey, which was supposedly a player that was pursuing the interests of the Muslim world and was safeguarding the Palestinian cause, ends up selling the cause. And it wasn't able to achieve anything by its foreign policy principles, so it begins selling causes and ideological objectives, which all showcase a crisis in its foreign policy identity.
Turkey has backed anti-Assad rebels in Syria, and Erdogan yet appears to be planning a new military incursion into Syria in coming months to take territory from Kurdish forces, rebels rather. Erdogan failed to enlist Russian and Iranian support for this, but he appears bent on maintaining the pressure. And Russia, the grid reads, given its own declining influence in Syria and the leverage Turkey has in Ukraine, probably won't push back too hard if Turkey invades. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei, though, warned Erdogan that any military operation in Syria would be detrimental for the region and play into the hands of terrorists. Turkey, he stressed, should view Syria's security as its own security. Erdogan has expressed concern, though, that Tel Rifat and Manbij have become hotbeds of terrorism, saying it is high time for them to be cleansed. Putin countered, saying that the Syrian government should take over control in the Kurdish-held northeast.
Syrian Kurds were trying to make a few cantons and can join these cantons, creating a corridor that starts from the Iraqi borders and ends near the Mediterranean Sea and Kurdish autonomous or confederal regions in this area. Turkey prevented the establishment of this Kurdish corridor with four operations, which Turkey called the corridor for terrorism, and this is an ongoing matter.
1 point all three Turkey, Russia and Iran agree on is that U.S. forces must leave Syria, and U.S.-backed forces or rebels must be quelled. We have certain differences concerning what is happening on the eastern bank of the Euphrates, said Putin, but we have a shared position that American troops must leave this territory. They must stop robbing the Syrian state, the Syrian people, with their illegal oil exports. American troops withdrawing from the northeast, Erdogan said, would make things easier for Turkey because it is America that has nourished the terrorist groups there.
Now Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish president, has stressed that we will start another operation, which starts in Manbij and Tel Rifat to Idlib and the borders of Iraq. All these areas, the Turkish army and the so-called National Syrian Army, which consists of 40 Salafi and Wahhabi Takfiri terrorist groups, which aim to control the north of Syria, and is also trying to construct 250,000 brick housing villas in this area in the future, and to bring at least 1 million Syrian refugees from Turkey to this area and the housing accommodations.
A Turkey-Russia talking point of international concern is that Turkey, which controls the southern entry to the Black Sea, has been negotiating a deal with both Ukraine and Russia. That would be to facilitate the shipment of grain through the sea in hope of ending a blockade that has contributed to a global hunger crisis. We are talking an export corridor for Ukrainian grain via Turkey. However, mines and ongoing combat in the sea may prevent shipping from resuming as normal, regardless of any deal. Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Plenty more coming up, but only after a quick media review. Here's what other media outlets have put down. The New York Times makes a reference to how Turkey is playing it both ways. Turkey's leader remains a headache for Biden despite aiding in Ukraine deal. When Russia and Ukraine reached an agreement on Friday to unblock Ukrainian grain exports, Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, played the role of benevolent statesman. But privately, Mr. Erdogan has remained a source of substantial irritation for Biden administration officials. Days before presiding over the grain agreement, the Turkish autocrat renewed a warning that he might veto NATO's plans to accept Sweden and Finland as members in the coming months, an act that would deeply embarrass the alliance and the Biden administration as they work to counter Russia. On Tuesday, Mr. Erdogan traveled to Tehran for meetings with Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and Russia's President Vladimir Putin. The images of two prime American rivals with Mr. Erdogan, the leader of a NATO country, clashed with the Western narrative of a deeply isolated Iran and Russia, analysts said. Then on Friday, a White House spokesman reiterated U.S. concerns about Mr. Erdogan's threats to mount a new invasion of northern Syria targeting U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters whom he considers terrorists. Taken together, Mr. Erdogan's actions and Mr. Biden's limited ability to restrain them underscore the Turkish leader's unique position as a military ally frequently at odds with the agenda of his Western allies. To U.S. officials, it is an often maddening role. But the Biden administration officials say that writing off Mr. Erdogan entirely would be self-defeating. His nation's position at the crossroads of East and West is strategically important and allows him to be an interlocutor with even more troublesome neighbors, as evidenced by the grain deal, which created a demilitarized corridor through the Black Sea for Ukraine's agricultural exports. Forest News has a piece on how the world order is changing. Putin says, multipolar world order evolving globally, process irreversible. A multipolar system of international relations has been actively evolving. The process is irreversible. It has been unfolding in front of our eyes, and it is objective in its nature, Putin stated, addressing the 10th St. Petersburg International Legal Forum. The position of Russia and many other countries is that this democratic, more just world order should be built on the basis of mutual respect and trust, and of course on the generally accepted principles of international law and the UN Charter. Putin said Russia is open to dialogue on ensuring strategic stability, preserving the non-proliferation modes of the weapons of mass destruction, and improving the situation in the sphere of arms control. The Russian leader added the aspiration to join efforts on such vitally important issues as the climate agenda, the war on hunger, ensuring the stability of food and energy markets, the fair rules of international trade and competition. That'll be it for the news section. Turkey will have to realign its alliances to serve and best profit from its eastern connection. Besides, Iran fears that new transport corridors sought by Azerbaijan and Turkey in the wake of the 2020 Nagorno-Karabakh war would cut off its land link with Armenia. Also, it charges Turkey's dam building on transboundary rivers with causing water shortages and drought in Iran.
Given trilateral talks between Iran, Russia and Turkey. Now the thing is, Turkey is a NATO member. What common interests does it really have with Iran and Russia that won't cause conflict?
Regional cooperation has become more prioritized compared to international cooperation, so much so that I should say that this Turkey, which is a player of the West in the region and is a member of NATO, finds it so alluring that it won't accept cutting off its ties with regional countries, even in the face of pressure. Turkey's market share in the regional countries cannot be ignored.
U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with hundreds of drones. Tehran denied the claim, although it didn't have to.
First of all, whether the Islamic Republic of Iran sells drones to Russia or not is an entirely domestic matter. And Iran has the right to sell its advanced military hardware to any country it sees fit, just like all other countries that are doing the same thing. But the second point is that the international order has reached this analytical conclusion that the power levels of the Islamic Republic of Iran, especially in the field of drone technology, which is a modern deterrent technology and few countries in the world have achieved it, has reached a level in the international order that the Russian Federation, as the world's best military force, has expressed its request to purchase a special type of drones from Iran. This aspect is far more important than the question that this sale will take place or not.
The joint statement of the summit appears more attentive to Turkish concerns than the Astana meeting in June. Parties reiterated their commitment to fighting terrorism in all its forms, highlighting serious concern over terrorist groups in Idlib. In reference to the Kurdish-led autonomy drive in the north, parties expressed determination to stand against separatist agendas and rejected all attempts to create new realities on the ground under the pretext of combating terrorism, including illegitimate self-rule initiatives.
The most important thing that was raised about Syria in the previous six Astana negotiations and again in the process of the seventh meeting is that the solution to the problem of Syria is considering the territorial sovereignty of this country, the exit of countries that lack a mutual understanding with the Syrian government and their respect towards the territorial integrity of Syria, making sure that the Syrian army is a competent military force that can repel any opposition in itself. Well, unfortunately, since the Turkish government has not formed any pacts or agreements with the Syrian government, it has increased its tensions by its presence in areas of the country and conducting military operations. That's why this matter was reiterated in the seventh meeting, that this problem must be dealt with by the central Syrian government.
Parties to the Tehran summit also rejected unilateral sanctions against Syria and urged international support for basic infrastructure projects to help the return of refugees. It's unconditional reconstruction that has been emphasized in the statement, and that's a sign Erdogan has diverged on this issue from Western allies. Putin's trip to Iran came shortly after Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia and Israel, the Zionist entity. Or U.S. President Biden's trip came just before Putin's trip to Iran. In any case, both men are seeking regional alliances, West Asian and Caspian. Now, President Putin's alliance with Iran will help him learn how to counter or survive U.S. sanctions. Also, it'll help him increase financial, political, and security gain from deepened bilateral relations with this country.
Regional countries, countries all over the world in the same region, have complementary economies. They are closer in terms of culture. Imagine India's capacity, China's capacity, which is geographically close to us, or Russia, or the Central Asia and Caucasus market, Turkey, Gulf states, if we can create a proper cycle and build multilateral regional trust. Our needs from the international market may greatly decrease. But the countries of this region hold such a power which can make global markets dependent on them. Based on Russia's plans for next year, it will be the largest exporter of grain in the world. Russia, Iran and other Arab countries hold the advantage when it comes to global energy. We are unfortunately preoccupied with political misunderstandings, the seeds of which have been originally planted by the West.
Given some Russian banks are cut off from the SWIFT international payment system also, Moscow is developing an alternative, and Iranian banks could be included in that. Perhaps deals to the exclusion of the dollar will also become feasible soon enough, be that with or without the introduction of a new currency, the ruble, perhaps.
In using local currencies, we're not talking about bilateral trade. We're talking of all Eastern states, all BRICS states working together. Now, I'm sure you're talking about a currency basket, but won't we need a single unit, a single monetary unit here, currency unit?
After the first Ukraine war in 2014, which led to the addition of Crimea to the Russian territories, and after the sanctions that were implemented against them, such as their exit, or we should say expulsion from the G8, making it the G7, the Russians effectively plan to both establish their own SWIFT system, a financial transaction channel, with the rest of the countries in the world and entities other than the current liberal democratic countries, and on the other hand, try to de-dollarize the national bank's treasury and purchase gold instead.
This episode focuses on Eastern alliances and a possible shift of power to the East in breaking unipolarity in the world.
After the Ukraine crisis, we witnessed that the National Atlantic Treaty Organization, which was an apparatus of the unipolar world order of the United States, revealed its lack of proficiency in dealing with the crisis. And fundamental disagreements have formed among European states that will only exacerbate, especially as we enter the cold season, where we will witness an increase in the disputes and even the fall of some other European governments. That's why